cas.uiuc.edu. Also, funds for this day of broadcasting come in part from a contribution by Alexis Tate in honor of her son Travis Tate on his 22nd birthday. Welcome to Focus 580. This is our number two of our program. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you listening. The producers for the show, Martha Deal, Harriet Williamson. In this part of Focus 580, we will be talking with a poet. Her name is Ruth Ellen Coker. She teaches literature and writing at the University of Missouri in St. Louis. She is here visiting the campus as part of the Carr Writers Series, the Carr Visiting Authors Reading Series. It's an event that's sponsored by the English Department and their MFA Creative Writing Program. And from time to time throughout the semester, here in the fall and the spring, they bring writers, various kinds of writers here, so that students will have an opportunity to meet with them and hear them talk about their work. And then also they give readings when they're here. And in fact, our guest will be making an appearance at the Author's Corner in the Illini Union Bookstore this afternoon at 4:30. So if you'd like to have the opportunity to hear from her and meet her, you certainly can do that. And also here this morning on the program, she's been good enough to come and spend some time with us to talk a little bit about writing and also to read from some of her work. She has published three collections, One Girl Babylon, When the Moon Knows You're Wandering, and Desdemona's Fire. She has won two major awards for her work, the Green Rose Prize in Poetry and also the Naomi Long Magid Poetry Award. And her work has appeared in many different literary journals, including African American Review, Antioch, and Plowshares. And as we talk here this morning, questions are welcome. If people who are listening would like to call in and talk with the guest, we certainly can do that here in Champaign-Urbana. The number to call is 333-9455. And we also have a toll-free line, and that one's good anywhere that you can hear us. That is 800-222-9455. So at any point here, you have questions, you would like to talk with the guest, you can do that. Well, thanks very much for being here.
Thanks for having me.
We certainly appreciate it. I have had to hear on this program off and on, I suppose, over the years, the opportunity to talk with some poets about their work. And I think probably I end up asking everybody at least one question I ask everybody. And that is, what about poetry, about the form of poetry, attracts you as opposed to writing in other kinds of ways?
You know, when I began writing, I actually began as a fiction writer when I was very young. Poetry was something that I thought of as a thing I played with as a child, I played with as a teenager. But when I became what I thought was a serious writer, when I went to college, I was writing prose, I was writing fiction. But after a while, after workshopping and spending time with my mentors, I realized that I was generally concerned a whole lot more with the way my language sounded than I was with the story or the plot. And I slowly migrated to poetry. And I think also along with the pure music of the language, I became fascinated with the concept of form and the way that the form of a poem on the page completely controls the way that we read the poem. And what I tell my students is that as poets, they have a power to control the way that other people breathe for that moment that they read the poem. And that fascinates me.
Mm-hmm. Certainly there are, when you talk about form, there are a lot of different ways to frame a poem, to structure a poem. And I'm sure that individual writers, they find things that work for them. And that's why they like those forms. I'm sure also there are times when perhaps a writer will say, challenge himself or herself and say, well, why don't I try and do it like this just to see if I can do it? Mm-hmm. Are there particular ways of structuring poems that to you just seem to work best? Does it have something to do with what it is that you're trying to say in any particular piece?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think so often the project at hand with any poem in particular dictates very much what the form will be. And in that way, you know, it's really organic to a certain extent. Right now I'm engaged in a project using a form that I've developed, a 16-line form that's kind of very rigorous and stringent. And it's the first time in my life that I've done that, that I have developed. developed or used a specific form and keep revisiting that same form over and over and over. But generally, in these books, I think the form is organic, and the poem itself ends up dictating often what that form will be. And there are times when I've wanted a poem to be in a particular form, but the language of the poem really resists that, and it's just not effective unless I kind of break down and let the language dictate to me what it will look like on the page.
Mm-hmm. I'm sure that inspiration comes for different writers. Inspiration comes in a lot of different ways. It comes from experience. It may come from something you just encounter, from images that suddenly present themselves, from things you overhear people saying, from things that you see, and that I'm sure that little pieces of things, perhaps as you go through life, you end up collecting them, and maybe then somehow they come back, or you can find them useful. Is there some way to talk about where key little bits come from, where key pieces of inspiration that then maybe grow, and then you work with, and then that becomes something bigger than what it started with?
Well, certainly from all of those sources that you mentioned, absolutely all of those sources that you mentioned. I'm one of those people who's a little bit of a, I guess you would say, a media file. You know, mm-hmm. I love media. I love to have images and sounds coming at me all the time. And I was just in Sacramento last week reading, and I mentioned to them that I think, you know, your students sometimes have this idea of you as always studious and scholarly, but I watch TV like anyone else, late night TV, infomercials, all of those things. And strangely enough, they feed poetry for me. I watch a lot of TV with the sound off, and I get images that then aren't attached necessarily to any specific meaning. And I see them pop up in the work. I'm constantly leafing through magazines or picking up books and reading, you know, the first few pages, listening to the radio. And I think that in some ways getting a flood of information like that is a way to almost trick your brain into finding ways to process it.
Hmm.
And, you know, it comes out in kind of interesting ways.
Well, now we've been talking for a little bit. I'd like to give you the opportunity to read something, and for people who are listening to hear you read something. Is there something that you could give that would illustrate that last point that you were making about how things can work for you?
Sure. Let me see if I can find a particular poem, and I think this might be an example of what I'm talking about. This poem is from the book When the Moon Knows You're Wandering, and it's a poem that I say it kind of lifts off in a little bit. It becomes a little bit fantastic, and you kind of have to trust the speaker and go along for the ride. But it certainly is a poem that I think came from a rash of images that I was getting in different places in my life. The long arm forward. The night I dreamed a crane draped in a gray sheet chased my lover into the woods near our home. The earth shook in Peru, covered 1,000 homes with mud and ash from a volcano believed dormant. My lover was running silently away. The crane was almost invisible under her sheet, just the tip of flapping wings and long yellow legs. In Peru, hands reach into rubble even now, the hands of dishes, the hands of wood, hands which are cold and warm, sometimes wet. Hands that reach for a heavy hold, that take us home, that speak somehow and mold their forms into light like flocks of pale birds. In this disaster, a woman remembers a decade ago her husband drowning and thinks, "Through me you exist and fail. You fail and exist again. Your mouth is full. Leave me. Leave me alone." She knows how easily lightning could erase her, how the same water that carried maroon legions of leaves past her home has changed her life, and the crane that haunts her sleep, so that it's not a crane, but a boy in a rain slicker with muddy boots the color of mangoes, chasing storm through the woods until he finds a stream. He is lost, And the woman? I am lost, and her husband lost and leaving. Yes, I am sleeping on long yellow legs and hear through rain the rumble of mountains very far away, their red flows steaming mud. I hear a mountain waking this world.
Very nice.
Thank you.
Can you talk a little bit about what was on your mind, or whether it was specific things that somehow got you started on this?
Well, you know, this poem ends up being really a synthesis of a lot of different things. It's a synthesis of a dream landscape that I found myself revisiting over and over at this particular time in my life. It's a synthesis of a rash of natural disasters that had happened in South America, in Peru, and in and then also in Guatemala. There's some, you know, personal experience and little glimmers that you get here and there. I was driving down the street in Arizona, and it's a very dry, arid place, if anyone has been there. And we had one particular day where it was just raining torrentially. It was during the monsoon season. And I saw a little boy standing on a corner, decked out in his rain slicker, boots and the slicker itself. And he was kind of wading through the wash that was coming down the drain, picking his knees up in a very pointed way, and I remember thinking he looked like a crane. I couldn't see his face. He looked like a crane, the way he picked his legs up. And all of those things ended up kind of blending together into this synthesis that ends up being this particular poem.
Yeah. This, see, for me, this is an example of how being able to hear someone talk about what they've written, mm-hmm. and do a little bit of what you've done and say, well, you know, here's kind of what inspired it and here's what I saw. To me, that enhances the poem greatly. I think it's wonderful just on the face of it, and I could just read it myself, or I could just hear you read it. But to me, that this I like the little added bit of backstory here that would suggest that the thing that I guess I think sometimes about poems is that they have secrets locked up in them, and that's difficult for an individual reader to pick the lock. And it's maybe only when the author comes along and says, "Okay, look, here's the key. I'm going to unlock it for you, and let me tell you something about it." And so it's hard to get that unless you actually can have the person who created it say, "Well, let me tell you a few things."
Well, I have to say, though, that for me, all of that background information isn't the key to the poem. It's just really a bonus. And I think that a good poem works without the reader necessarily needing all of that privilege information that brought the writer to it, that brought the writer to the occasion. One of the nice things about going to poetry readings is you get to hear commentary about the work and how something came about to be. But there's something about us as inquisitive, intelligent human beings that we want to know sometimes when it comes to poetry how the writer came to it. I don't necessarily need to know how the knitter discovered the yarn that she used to put together my sweater, what it was about that particular color that intrigued her for me to enjoy wearing that sweater. But there is something about the poem, and I think probably because of the speakerly voice of the poet, that makes the reader feel that they need to know what that voice is thinking. And it's an inquisitive position that, you know, I think in some ways you have to almost abandon a little bit in order to truly enjoy poetry. But you can always get that added commentary if you go to poetry readings, which is what's so wonderful, because you get the book and you get to hear the writer read his or her own work. But you also get those little glimmers of backstory, which is sweet.
I guess I wonder whether if it isn't the case that maybe the reason that more people aren't interested in poetry is that they have come up against work and it just seems impenetrable. And they just say, well, I don't get this, and so that's where they start.
Well, there are many different kinds of poetry out there. There's poetry that maybe will make you work a little bit more as a reader, and there's poetry that's highly accessible. when it comes to people, when you say people not being very interested in poetry, you know, there's a very large community of people writing and reading poetry out there. And I think that in some ways, the only reason why it's not, quote unquote, more popular is because it's just not plugged into so much of the machinery of media these days, in the same way that something like fiction is, which is really very much plugged in to market value and media and cinema and all of those things, which popularize it in a way that I find kind of fascinating. And poetry is, in some ways, unadulterated in that way. It's one of these art forms that, that unlike music or even art, even painting, just really doesn't become part of a popular market. Now, I say that, and at the moment I say it, I remember watching a car commercial last year, and I can't remember the name of the car commercial, and they were quoting Robert Frost. And I thought, oh, how funny. Is this the day? Is this what's become of poetry, that it's come into a popular market? But for the most part, it's one art form that just has not found that kind of commercial landing, and I think maybe to the benefit of poetry.
Well, that's, yes, I'm sitting here thinking about, there are probably a lot of poets who are thinking that if the day comes that someone decides they can make money off poetry, then we're in big trouble.
Exactly, exactly. And so maybe that's something that keeps it, allows it to have a certain integrity, and it also allows the poet to write to his or her own intent. So you have poetry that's very narrative and very accessible, and you have poetry that's highly lyrical, say, poetry that may be much more experimental in terms of language and diction, which is kind of nice to have all those choices.
So you would say that for when you start out, primarily you're just writing for yourself?
You know, I have to say it has not occurred to me who I'm writing for or why I'm writing. It's a practice that I undertake. I think sometimes I tell people, you know, some people make quilts, some people make cabinets, and I make poems. It's really, it's a kind of a high craft for me. And the act of crafting language makes me feel as though poets are artisans in a certain way.
Do you write every day?
No. I don't write every day. I don't really have a ritual, or, you know, there's nothing romantic about the process for me, nothing lovey-dovey, nothing really poetic. Sometimes I get that quiet moment that people imagine where I'm at my desk in my study and I'm looking out the window. Mm-hmm. And sometimes I'm sitting on the couch with my laptop next to my daughter who's watching SpongeBob. And sometimes I'm in the kitchen trying to cook some dinner and I have to take a break to go write down a few lines. Sometimes I'm teaching. Sometimes I'm in my office and I need to close the door. It happens for me all the time. It's really kind of an integral part of my life. I'll go for days, even weeks sometimes, without writing anything. And then maybe sometimes I'll write very intensely for days and days and days on end. I'm not very ritualistic about it at all. And I'm sorry if I've dispelled any fantasies about the writer's life.
And what we go for in this program is reality. And I think that also reflects some of the ideas that people have about writers and about poetry in particular, that I think we're really hung up on the idea that it's the process of some sort of flash inspiration that does, though, happen in these certain quiet moments, that the poet goes out and sits beside a stream underneath the tree and it's like an apple falls out and hits them on the head and suddenly, oh, there's the poem, okay. And they furiously write it down. That's that. Mm-hmm. I mean, I don't think that really people appreciate the extent to which that kind of writing, or any kind of writing, is craft, and it maybe is like building a piece of furniture.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there's certainly a building process to the poem, and you know, some poems I'm not very many, but some poems I'm very lucky enough to sit down and write, and I feel as though maybe they don't need a lot of tinkering. I go back and I craft the language a little bit, and I find the form. But for the most part, you know, I sit down and I work on a poem, and it takes a while to get to that final product. The poems that I'm working on right now, which are 16-line forms, I find that the last couplet is the most difficult thing to write for me. And a lot of times I'll have the poem sitting on my my computer screen for days with the cursor just blinking at the bottom. You know, it's a 16-line poem, and after line 14, I just have this blinking cursor for days because I can't write that last couplet. And I'll write it over and over, and I erase it over and over. It's a process. I have poet friends who have taken years to really perfect and kind of really substantiate a single piece until they get it to the place that they really feel comfortable with it.
Our guest in this part of Focus 580 is Ruth Ellen Coker. She's a poet. She teaches literature and writing at the University of Missouri at St. Louis. She's here visiting the campus as part of the Carr Visiting Authors reading series. She'll be doing a reading this afternoon at the Illini Union Bookstore, 4:30. That's on the U of I campus, and anybody who's interested should feel welcome to attend. She's here visiting, as other writers have, to talk with students, and we're pleased that she could be here with us. And questions are welcome, too, if you'd want to call in, 333-9455 and toll-free 800-222-9455. Would you read something else?
Oh, sure. I have a poem that is maybe perhaps a little bit more narrative. I like to read this poem. I think I probably read it every time I give a reading because it's a little humorous to me, although the poem itself is not humorous. And the circumstances of the poem are fairly self-explanatory in the title. The title of the poem is "Ode to the Woman Who, on the day I earned a doctorate, mistook me as a shoe clerk." I want to tell you, I loved how your shoes sparkled like the muted gold flecked into an East Coast diner's creamy Formica countertop. I want to tell you how I imagined them on my wide feet, yellow and crusted with the desert of 5 years, walks to the library, to my truck, to the bar, to my classroom, to my office, the copy machine always down, and to the bar again. And yes, I imagined the thin slips of leather emerging from beneath a plum-colored robe that would embarrass and thrill me as I walked the procession gowned over my round shoulders. I would sit in just 4 hours through long speeches by deans I had never known, but who were happy to tally another retention with a handshake. I could have forgotten the head cap of my mortarboard, too small to crown thick African twist damp with pomade and beeswax. I could have forgotten your tap on my shoulder at just the moment I was remembering mangoes hanging heavy on a sparse tree near the top of Saba Island, so close to the cliff the sea longed to swallow one whole. But I didn't. I did not tell you that you were mistaken, or that my husband's skin rose into goose flesh at my touch that morning, even after 10 years of waking to the same black mole on my shoulder. I kept from you the moment, a month before, I had cradled a student in my arms because the year had mugged her and left her bruised. And so you couldn't know that the smell of dust from rotting volumes of Gertrude Stein replaced the stench of toilets my teenage hands scrubbed in other people's homes because government programs for us kids at risk risked us. I did not tell you because you were right in noticing every brown face in that store name-tagged, your beautiful feet pedicured into acceptance. I want to tell you now, never to read this poem aloud in your home as Esperanza, your maid, listens at the sink. Never read it, because the words will sift through your ears and fall into the forgotten spaces between your ribs. They will rattle in your gut. They will circle the chasms within your shins and fall to the hollow of each smooth foot, just near the arch, lost to any hope of hearing. And Esperanza does not need to hear them, not from your lips, because she can still take her own name home at night, lotion her knees, peel an orange into the distance measured between the two doorways of her apartment, and love the sharp scent. Love how it becomes her life, like the words of this poem, and how, for a few hours, the citrus oil hanging in the air washes you away.
Did this actually happen to you?
It did. Not all poems are true, and I emphasize that, especially when I'm teaching. I think that in some ways we're held unduly to the truth as poets. And people think of poetry as some kind of privileged truth. But a lot of times for me in constructing a poem, the situation at hand doesn't necessarily lend itself to anything interesting. And so I construct the content of the poem as well. And this poem in particular is, it is based on an occasion that I actually experienced on the day, literally, that I was about to receive my doctorate. And it was a moment when I felt a little powerless, and I didn't know what to say to this poor woman who I've forever kind of marred in this poem. I didn't know what to say to her, and so at that moment, I smiled and just said, "I'm sorry, I don't work here." But I thought about it for the rest of the day, even as I was standing in commencement. And as I thought about it, I got more and more angry. And I thought, is there ever a time in my life, is there ever a time in my life when I'm not going to be mistaken as the clerk in the store or the Target representative, which has happened to me too. If I wear a red shirt in Target, you have to be careful of that. And so this poem kind of came about for me as a way to respond to her in a way that I couldn't in that very moment.
Mm-hmm. Well, you had to, not everyone would be able to have that experience and then end up making a poem out of it. I'm sure that a lot of people would just irk them no end, and they would tell people that they knew, and they would share that story and not have the opportunity to get it out, sort of to get it off your chest, so to speak, in a way like this. Does being able to do this give you some sense of, being able to do something with it that's somehow constructive or to get it, does getting it out on the page make you feel any better about it?
Well, you know, it's not the act so much of getting it out on the page as converting it and allowing it to transform into something beautiful for the most part. I learned that from, I was talking to a colleague of mine, Tayemba Jess, who teaches here, a fine, fine poet. And we were talking a little earlier about one of my mentors, Bruce Weigel. And I learned that from Bruce, who is what some people would call a Vietnam-era poet, and who came back from Vietnam and all of the experiences that he had there and was somehow able to use them to produce the most stunning, shockingly stunning, and yet devastating poetry. And so I learned from him that maybe one of the greatest things that a poet can do is to transform the awful into something beautiful and lovely. And so for me, it's not so much the act of getting it out or an act of revenge as a way to transform that experience and allow it to have a metamorphosis into something else.
Mm-hmm. Are there, and this is sort of an awkward and very general question, but are there, would you say, particular themes or particular things that you find, maybe not intentionally, but you find as you look at the body of work that you've put together that you realize you're coming back to or doing again and again?
When I find those things, I stop doing it, you know. And mm-hmm. I have these little rules for myself. And it's a way to make sure that my writing continues to grow. With the project that I have now, I had just come out of a manuscript that I'd written using a revisionist myth, writing about classic mythology in a way that may be new or more contemporary, sometimes from a personal perspective. And one of the reasons why I did that was because I kept seeing this device, this poetic device, pop up in my work in some of the other books. And I thought, why not just dedicate an entire project to this idea? Once I did that, though, I was kind of unable to stop. And so in my current project, I set out some rules for myself. And the first rule was no allusions to myth, mythology, or literature. So no literary or mythological allusions, rule one. And I think that's sometimes important in order to grow as a poet, in order to kind of take yourself out of your comfort zone and rediscover something that you had forgotten about in terms of your ability and your skill.
So do those rules, do they stay with you, or for that, was that just for a certain amount of time you're trying to do certain things? I'll sort of say, this is what I want to do and this is what I will not do. Is it that collection of rules doesn't keep growing and you don't take them with you forever?
It depends. You know, it depends. For a long time I had decided that I wasn't going to, after I wrote When the Moon Knows You're Wandering, I had to have a moratorium on moons, for example.
No more moons.
And part of it's just because we as poets and writers, we love language, and I love the word moon. I love the long vowel sound in moon. And I also noticed that not only was I using the word moon a lot, but I was using other words that rhymed with moon a lot. Moon, blue, you. Yeah, I was doing it over and over. And so I said, okay, you know, you have to stop that because it becomes less effective. It loses power if it's something that becomes overused. So it depends on, you know, it depends on what the tick is, whether I allow myself to go back to it or not.
We have a caller here to talk with who would like to talk with you. Let's do that. They're in Champaign, line one. Hello.
Hi.
Hi.
I would love to come to the reading, but I'm ill. But anyway, I'll tell you a little about me and then ask my question. I'm 70 years old. I'm a poet, sort of, and a nurse. And my question is, does the media make a big difference? I have a laptop, but does the media make a big difference to a poet? And I'll hang up and listen to your answer.
Okay. The mechanical, I guess the question is the mechanical device, you know, if you sit and you write at paper and pencil, you sit and you write with computer, I guess that's pretty much your options.
So she said medium.
That's what I understood. Essentially, I think that's what she meant, yeah.
I thought at first she had said media, and I was thinking, well, does poetry matter to the media? That would be the answer. But medium, for me, it makes a big difference. A lot of poets are very attached to the mechanical nature of writing out their poems, either in pencil or in pen. I know a few poets out there that still have a few old typewriters sitting around. Maybe they're actually electric, but I'm not sure. And some writers start out writing longhand and then will go to the computer. This is an idiosyncrasy of mine. Before I went back to school, I took a little break from school years ago. I was working in ad production at a newspaper. I was a typesetter, and these are, not to belie my age, but these are days before desktop publishing.
They don't have typesetters
no,
anymore.
They don't have physical people that sit in a room and typeset anymore. But I was a typesetter, which meant that it was my job to write copy for the ads or for the newspaper. And I became a very fast typist at that time. And so for me, when I actually sit down to write and I'm trying to write longhand, especially when I'm having kind of furious thoughts and I'm trying to keep up with them, it's very frustrating to not be able to write as fast as I can think. And so for me, I use the computer. Before I used a computer, I used a typewriter. But the computer was so much better for me because I could really quickly get some language down on the paper. And I feel as though I can get it down and complete the thought on the paper before I forget what I was thinking in my mind. So it matters for me. I don't like much writing longhand unless I'm just copying some notes into a journal or something for later.
All right. Well, I hope that gets to the question of the caller. Others are welcome here as we continue to talk with our guest, Ruth Ellen Coker. She's a poet. She teaches literature and writing at the University of Missouri at St. Louis, and she is here on the campus to take part in the CAR Visiting Authors Reading Series. This is sponsored by the English Department's MFA Creative Writing Program, and they've brought a number of writers to different kinds of writers to the campus so students can talk with them, and we've had the chance to talk with some of them as well. Led to some good conversations here on this program. She will be giving a reading by the Way, that will be at the Author's Corner. This is in the Illini Union Bookstore on the U of I campus this afternoon at 4:30. And anyone who is interested in hearing, I'm sure, should feel welcome. It's open to the public. She has three collections of her work, Desdemona's Fire, One Girl Babylon, and When the Moon Knows You're Wandering. And again, questions are welcome. Well, we're coming into about our last, I don't know, about 15 minutes, and I certainly would like to have you read something else.
Wonderful. Sure. This poem, a few years ago, my husband and I adopted a little girl, a four-year-old girl, and her name is Kaylee. And I actually dedicate this book to her. The dedication reads, for Kaylee, who has already known too much, and for Kobe, who sustains her. Kobe is my husband. And we, you know, we had a very adult life and a very adult marriage with no children for many, many years. I think 14 years of marriage with no children. We had our routines. And one night we had come home from a charity art auction at the university that I was working for. And I think of this almost like a caricature of us. We had bought a vase, and the weekend before we had just purchased this beautiful antique dresser, and we were standing in our bedroom with the vase on top of our beautiful dresser, having a cocktail, a pretty martini in a pretty glass, kind of admiring this moment in our adult lives. And the phone rang, and it was my mother on the phone. My mother is a social worker in Pennsylvania. And my mother said, I've never asked you to do anything for me, and I need you to do this. Those were her words. And what unfolded was the story of the adoption of my daughter. And it was really a harrowing experience and put an abrupt end to that kind of life that we had. And this poem is one of the first poems that I wrote about my daughter, concerned with that whole experience. It was a day that my husband and I and she had gone off to this little winery in Piasaw in Grafton, Illinois. And we were talking about the upcoming adoption and what we were going to do about her last name. And I was at the time also trying to very hard to maintain my life as a writer. And trying to incorporate that into becoming a mom to the special needs child. And things were a little crazy. So the title of the poem is called Ars Poetica, or Adoption Palimpsest at the Piasaw Winery, Grafton, Illinois. And let me just preface by telling you that Ars Poetica is a title that we give to a poem that is about the art of writing poetry. And a palimpsest is a tablet in ancient art, and there are paintings like this too on canvas, where there's another painting underneath, and it was used as sometimes a template or sometimes just raw material in order to produce this other template. So it's actually writing or painting something over something that had already existed. Okay. Too far away, my husband and the girl I call my daughter edge the river, complete without me, barge passing behind them. She picks up a rock, lobs it toward current. Last week, Carl, the swim instructor, watching her 5 years arc high above him, hands first into 6 feet of blue water, calls her fearless. Over the bluegrass rendition of I've Found the Light, I chat with the aging Harley couple, her breasts sculpted for resistance to wind and wandering. They call out for BB when the band stops, wink at me as though somehow to them I am dear. Last week, the talk, changing her name, hyphens and matriarchies lost to nomenclature. Talk about tensions between fricatives, conflicting Ys and Rs, the efficacy of consonants and the inevitable sovereignty of vowels. The Miles CD plays as intermission.
He pulls up a chair next to me, 2 miles outside his Alton home, a decade after his death, squeezes out 3 long, fine notes while I watch the barge hesitate its way downstream. Same swell as sun gathered around the horn's curve. My husband and the girl I call daughter, still far, climb an old stone foundation covered with grass. Miles flashes into momentary static. The banjo player resumes, "You are my sunshine." A man passes, beautiful but unsure. Miles says in 3 more notes, fading, "When you were unmarried and younger, thinner, and not a mother, the stranger inside you would have seduced him easily, held his face in your hands until the strength of your eyes collapsed him." A long sip of Luc Perlet, I search for a pen. The poem, like Miles, escapes this place, floats above the umbrella canopy mounted inside the circle of my tabletop, sure in its existence beyond the unfair grip of language. Husband and girl run toward me, the memory of fullness in their hands. Hmm.
So tell me about this idea of having the palimpsest, about this idea of having the one image or the one picture there and the other painted over it. And I think isn't sort of the idea is that you can still see the first one, sort of, you can see it coming through the second one?
Yeah, sometimes and sometimes not. And in this particular poem, that's exactly what happens, that the occasion for this poem was my attempt to write a poem that had nothing to do with my husband and daughter. And I was, you know, sitting in this beautiful setting. I'm sitting at a winery. I have the table to myself. He's taken her away to get her out of my hair. And they're playing along the riverbank. And I want to write a poem, which I'm engaged in. And I can't. I just simply can't. And so in the frustration of writing some lines that are failing, I just start looking around me and writing down what's happening. And what happens around me becomes the poem, as opposed to the poem that I thought I was writing. Which is why I say I search for a pen, but the poem escapes me, mm-hmm. As Miles escaped this place. And I think that sometimes speaks to, and especially in my experience of becoming a kind of sudden mom, it speaks to experiences that we have every day about sometimes missing the things that are right in front of us. And not thinking of them as the substantial thing in our life when, you know, very much those are the things that are anchoring us and grounding us.
Had you, I'm sorry, this is a personal question that has nothing to do with writing poetry. Had you and your husband not, were having children not part of your plan?
Well, they maybe had been, and then we didn't have children, and we had, for the most part, decided that we probably weren't going to do that. We had kind of settled into this routine and thought, well, you know, this is nice. This is all very nice. And it was very sudden.
Yeah, I'll bet. Imagine if mom calls and says, look, I have this child.
It was very sudden. And it was, the funny thing about this time is that I think of it as the first easy time. You know, I been through graduate school and I had published some, and I was just at this time where I was kind of floating and thinking, well, this is good. This is nice. This is a good life. And it was as though I thought that a little too hard. And I have this idea that I play with sometimes, which was what spawned the myth manuscript that I was telling you about. And I imagine sometimes that the gods exist and that they are all sitting on this red plush sofa in the sky and they're watching us and laughing, you know. And the minute you say, yeah, I think that things are kind of nice and easy now, they chuckle to themselves and they just toss a lightning bolt at you.
You should never say that. Never say that out loud.
That's right. And at that very moment, that's exactly what they did. They tossed this little 4-year-old lightning bolt at me, and that's the best way to describe her. I mean, she's her own weather system, and she needed a lot of
attention and love, and she had been through a harrowing experience and just completely turned my easy life upside down, which is, you know, which I am thankful for now. But at the time, it was a whirlwind.
Hmm. We're coming down to our last, I don't know, maybe about 3-4 minutes. Something I wanted to ask you about, and this is going to, this is maybe a technical point, and I don't, you know,
sure.
I'm not a poet, and I'm not an expert on poetry, and I'm sure there's all sorts of things in the mechanics of the poems that does not come to my notice. But one thing that does is how you like sometimes to put words together that start with the same sound, and which is I'm sure is interesting. It does interesting things, including just helping to propel things along, and I guess I'm just interested in, because I noticed it, in that as a device, what it does. Is there something particularly about that attracts you, and whether also you have to say to yourself, "Now I don't want to do that too many times."
Mm-hmm.
Yeah,
sure.
It's this kind of thing you could easily overdo.
Isn't there an example that you were thinking of?
Well, of course, now that I've said it, I will be hard pressed
I have to say that one of the things about poetry that really drives me and motivates me is sound. I'm very much seduced by the sound of language and the sound of words, and those things are little indulgences for me. I like to hear language sing, and when I teach, it's the thing that I try to impress upon my students, maybe more than anything, that I need to hear the ancient art form of lyric in their poems, regardless of what kind of poetry they're writing. I want to hear it sing. And so that's what's happening there. And you're right that anytime you overuse a device, it really becomes less powerful. And so you have to meter those things. You really have to meter them and use them to their greatest effectiveness.
So at what point in writing a poem and developing a poem do you, for the first time, read it out loud to yourself? So at least you can hear yourself.
From the first moment.
From the beginning.
From the first moment, I'm constantly chanting the poem out loud to myself. The entire thing is really an oral exercise for me.
I have a caller here. We'll get him in before we end up out of time. Over
Great.
In Indiana, line 4. Hello.
Hello.
Yeah.
It's been an amazing aesthetic experience, I must admit. Exceptional talent, undoubtedly. I want to thank you.
Thank you.
Dave, for having her.
Sure.
And I think she started making me think about the old days when I had teachers, and I think the present generation is well hands, very good hands.
Thank you very much.
Oh, thank you for the call. One of the things that I probably have also tried to talk a little bit with some of the people who've here to talk about their writing, who are also teachers, is to talk about that, to talk about working with poets. And I'm sure, I don't know if it's different from the challenge of working with a different kind of young writer. And I'm sure that always one of the difficult things, no matter what your kind of writing is and their kind of writing is to steer a sort of course between trying to give that person the opportunity to be the kind of writer that they are, and your impulse, you know, it's the old joke about how the oldest impulse is to be an editor and to want to change somebody else and to say something and do it like, rather than helping them do it the best way they could do it, for you to come along and say, well, this is the way that I would do it.
Right. And you're right. I think my job really is to help them facilitate their own invention and their own discovery for the most part. And so I think more than a teacher, I'm a mentor to a certain extent. I mean, student writers are, I think of them as kind of wild ponies in some way. And I don't really want to tame them that much. I just want to keep them in the corral for the most part.
Do you find a lot of people come, they from the first they want to be poets, or are there more writers who, say somebody like you, who maybe started out writing prose and then somehow came to poetry after that?
I think it comes both ways. I have a student now who's a prose writer and about ready to get his Master of Fine Arts degree as a prose writer, and he's just beginning to write poetry, and he's really a fantastic poet. And I think he brings something to the poem that's specific from his experience. But I think people come from all walks of life. I have students who are as young as 23, and I have students who are in their 60s and 70s. One of my students right now is a 60-something-year-old rabbi who loves Prince And, you know, it's fascinating.
Prince the musician,
mm-hmm.
Prince?
Yeah, like Purple Rain.
Like formerly known as and currently known as.
When Doves Cry.
Yeah. Yeah.
Let's Get
yeah,
Crazy.
Yeah, I know the guy. Well, yeah. Not personally, but yeah.
Well, that's an experience. So, you know, being a teacher is as much of a blessing sometimes as being a poet.
Yeah. Well, it's been very nice having you here. I certainly appreciate it.
Thank you so much. It was enjoyable. Fun.
And for people who are here in and around Champaign-Urbana, if you would like to hear more from our guest, Ruth Ellen Coker, you have the opportunity. She will be in the Author's Corner at the Illini Union Bookstore this afternoon at 4:30 and reading from her work. It's part of the Carr Authors series. And otherwise, you can look for her collections, Desdemona's Fire, One Girl Babylon, When the Moon Knows You're Wandering. She teaches literature and writing at the University of Missouri at St. Louis. Just here, we're almost finished, but before we go, I do need to make sure that people know that this show, Focus 580, is made possible in part by a grant from Bodywork Associates, offering licensed massage therapy to Champaign-Urbana since 1982. Bodywork Associates has opened a new office inside the Oasis Center in the Illini Union. The broadcast today is also made possible with support from Owens Funeral Home at the corner of Elm and University in Champaign, locally owned and operated and serving families since 1925. The staff at Owens Funeral Home invites you to join them in supporting public radio. Coming up tomorrow morning on our program, we'll talk a little bit about the movie business in the first hour. The guest will be David Waterman. He's professor in the Department of Telecommunications at Indiana University, and we'll be talking about a recent book that he's written that's titled Hollywood's Road to Riches. We'll talk about the economics of the film business and how perhaps that has changed over time. And then in the second hour, to a regional kind of issue, we'll be talking a little bit about current events in Sri Lanka. And our guest there will be Chandra Da Silva. He is dean of the Faculty of Arts and Letters and professor of history at Old Dominion University. And he'll be joining us by phone. Both guests will. We're here weekday mornings from 10 until noon. We have 10 different topics every week. We always welcome your questions and comments. And right now, we hope that you will stay tuned because coming up next, it's the Afternoon Magazine. The host of the show, Celeste Quinn.
Thank you very much, David. Coming up today in the 1 o'clock hour of the Afternoon Magazine, we will talk with Pulitzer Prize winning historian Doris Kearns Goodwin about her latest book, Team of Rivals. It looks at this question: how was it that Abraham Lincoln rose from frontier lawyer to become president? We'll talk with Doris Kearns Goodwin about Lincoln's political acuity in the 1 o'clock hour today of the Afternoon Magazine. Joining us now with the latest from the commodity markets, Dave Dickey. Dave.
Thank you much, Celeste, and good afternoon, everyone. Not a high volume day thus far, but staying steady over in Kansas City. March wheat at 430, 8.5 down 1.5. March wheat at the Chicago Board of Trade, 366.5 down 6. May, 378 and 3/4.